we practice long-term, concentrated, value-focused investing. We invest in publicly traded stocks, but we treat it like we are investing in private companies. The goal for today is to talk about Astrana and managed care in California. Could you spend a minute walking me through your background?
I was an undergraduate at the University of North Carolina at VCU Medical College of Virginia in Richmond. After that, I moved to Las Vegas to do the third year of a master's program. I worked for a staff model health maintenance organization. I spent the first 5 years in various roles there, including ending up as chief of staff for Sierra Health. I had really cut my teeth in population health management at that point. I spent 5 years as corporate VP of managed care for a smaller hospital company that had facilities mostly in the southern United States, overseeing network strategy and managed care contracting. For the following 15 years, I worked for two groups. The first was Healthcare Partners Medical Group, who were one of the earliest pioneers in population health management before it became sexy. I joined them as their senior VP of managed care operations for Nevada. Ultimately, in 2012, we sold to DaVita. Once that transaction closed, I began spending half my time doing national and global risk contracting for a number of the Healthcare Partners DaVita Medical Group locations across the country. The two founders left the company in 2015. In 2017, they partnered with Chicago Pacific Founders and received some of their seed money to get going. I was their first employee and we started P3 Health Partners. Over the next 8 years, we grew it from an idea to managing 125,000, mostly Medicare Advantage lives across 5 states. We had also started an ACO REACH, Accountable Care Organization Realizing Equity, Access, and Community Health program. I held various roles, including Chief Operating Officer and Chief Managed Care Officer for P3. We took the company public in 2021 via SPAC. I left 9 months ago. They have not done well, like many SPAC companies who have gone under. They are still hanging in there, but only by a thread. I am currently working for a smaller, scrappy, national, diversified company, heavy in the multi-specialty pharmacy management space. We are doing some really cool things, trying to grow and help save self-funded health plans and smaller health plans money, while moving the company from heavy fee-for-service into the value-based payment world. We are standing up a payer vertical and doing some M&A work and growth.
You mentioned that you have some background or involvement with Astrana. Can you elaborate on that?
I worked with Chan Basho, their COO at Healthcare Partners. He was in our California office as a VP of network. I had network the entire time I was with Healthcare Partners for 7 years, so I worked very closely with him on some projects. The founder of my current company is an ex-investment banker. He saw an opportunity in healthcare and started buying practices. One of his first practices was in Las Vegas, which is how the company got headquartered there. He started rolling up both specialty and primary care. When he got to 9 PCP clinics, 7 in Las Vegas and 2 in Texas, he spun them off to Apollo, which is now Astrana. I worked very closely with Lucas Taylor, the market president for Arizona and Nevada. When he was at Alignment Healthcare, I sat across the table and negotiated contracts with him. I worked directly and indirectly with Apollo Medical Holdings before they rebranded to Astrana.
What did you do with Lucas Taylor? What was his role at Astrana?
He was market president for Arizona and Nevada. I know Brandon Sim, who is the son of one of the founders. Brandon relocated the company to Las Vegas a year or two ago.
I thought they relocated to Las Vegas.
Corporate headquarters moved to Las Vegas. Brandon just had a baby. Their office is literally a few blocks away from ours.
What is your impression of what they are trying to do at Astrana and how they are doing it? Healthcare Partners and P3 are in industry where many companies seem to have success for a time and then struggle. So what is your impression of what Brandon is doing at Astrana? Can he beat the odds?
Our focus at P3 was nearly exclusively Medicare Advantage. And when you get too dependent on one line of business, it can be problematic. Astrana have a diversified portfolio, which is good. Healthcare is currently a more difficult place to be in because there are a lot of headwinds from the Medicare side. They take global risk on the Medicare side, so there is some pressure there. On the commercial side, higher single-digit increases are occurring. I don't think they are global risk on commercial generally. I think they have some type of capitation and upside, but I am not that close to their contract structures. Medicaid is another line of business where you are at the whim of the state. The largest spend of any state's budget is healthcare. So when things get tight, it is the first thing looked at, and oftentimes on the chopping block. They are facing headwinds, but I think they are nimble and have been successful. Lucas is in the Arizona and Nevada markets, which are much smaller than California. They recently decided to take a big bite of the apple with Prospect. Now they have some struggling hospitals, some of which they have divested, but they will have to turn around. I think they can do that if they have the right operators. They have some IPAs, an expanded footprint on the population health management side. I don't know all of the folks running their operations outside of California. I think California is a market where they have been managing that business for a long time, and they should continue to be successful. The question is, outside of California, as they have expanded with Prospect and beyond, are they going to be able to really turn the corner there? I am not as close to the folks running the Prospect side of the house, but I know that Prospect has had its challenges. They have a significant amount of core assets and primary care presence, but healthcare is cyclical and is currently going through one of those more difficult periods. They probably need to digest the Prospect acquisition, but if they can weather the storm, I suspect they will be able to come out on the back end in years to come in a good position. CMS have been a little kinder than the previous administration was for Medicare Advantage. We will see what happens in the coming years, but I know Medicare Advantage is a big chunk of their business.
Both Healthcare Partners and P3 also struggled. Can you tell me what went wrong there? Astrana seemed to be doing comparatively better than others in a tough environment. Why you think that might be, and is that sustainable or not?
Healthcare Partners were doing extremely well. They were involved in a $4.4 billion transaction. DaVita thought they could run medical groups like they ran dialysis centers. While Kent Theory is arguably one of the smartest individuals I have ever personally known and built a very strong culture and highly successful operation at DaVita, managing doctors is not like managing dialysis techs. He even described DaVita at one point as running a bunch of Taco Bells. You cannot be successful managing physician practices that way. I think they immediately got rid of a lot of the management team and long-term executives. At one point, I was among the top 40 executives at Legacy Healthcare Partners. Years later, after the transaction, I think you could count on one hand the number of us who are still there. Getting rid of all your leadership and bringing in new leadership that didn't understand the population health management side was a big part of that problem. That was the demise of Healthcare Partners. P3 didn't have a problem growing, and when we first started, it was all about growth. When we went public, right as we entered COVID, the market changed and no longer cared about growth. All the market cared about was profitability. We had entered into a number of long-term global risk arrangements where trying to change the mechanics was difficult. We probably made some decisions entering into a few contracts that we should not have in order to grow. We thought we could take an almost exclusively network model and teach a bunch of doctors who had only known fee-for-service how to do population health management, even in rural areas. It proved to be far more difficult than originally thought. The real issue with P3 was a lack of cash. When we went public, we were probably at a burn rate close to $100 million. We thought we were going to end up with a lot more cash than we did. Right after we went public, we had maybe 12 months of cash and immediately had to begin addressing that. We didn't have the infrastructure we needed to be a publicly traded company. We were heavily lacking in the finance and accounting world. We had a very small legal SEC team. Our audits weren't clean. We were facing many issues and constantly didn't have enough cash. Our burn rate got up to $125 million. That continues to be their Achilles heel to this day.
Why were they unable to manage these lives well enough to make these at-risk relationships profitable?
In some areas like Nevada and California, we got to profitability, but several big contracts in Arizona and Oregon became problematic. Florida was profitable, and we needed the cash so much that we divested Florida, much to my chagrin at the time. There were probably only three contracts that were dragging down much of the performance. Working with a health plan to get data submitted was challenging. There were multiple times where one of the health plans we were working with failed to submit a lot of the risk adjustment data.
Did you not have any recourse for them failing to do what they were presumably supposed to under the terms of the contract?
We did. There were fingers pointed because they had made some benefit changes one year and increased benefits significantly, and we didn't sign off on it. We were constantly fighting legally. In at least one case, it was with a related party, which made it more difficult. Ultimately, while we did get some remuneration, it wasn't what it should have been. Many times we were asked to work with vendors that were related parties, new and unproven, and oftentimes they didn't pan out.
You have seen this model work, and you have also seen it struggle. I am trying to understand whether Astrana will turn out like P3, or maybe they are the one that breaks the mold and actually builds a durable managed care business over time. Has anyone in this business actually worked durably over time in an example you can point to?
It depends on what your time frame is. Healthcare Partners was highly successful.
If I want to own a business that I can pass down to my children,
the managed care space, or Medicare Advantage, which many organizations like Oak Street, ChenMed, Healthcare Partners, and IPA have focused on because of the dollar opportunity, has seen tough times. Medicare has moved the goalposts enough to cause serious repercussions for the plans, and these risk-bearing provider groups are downstream from there. The plans have not always played fair either. I have worked with every one of the major plans, and United and Humana represent the preponderance of the Medicare Advantage business. I have worked with both and seen them do things that were not nefarious, but they were moving things around, and there were legal issues we got into with all the managed care organizations. These organizations wanted to grow, so they would throw out incredibly rich benefits. It was difficult at times to fully get held harmless for some of these benefits. Behind the scenes, they would pass costs to you that should not have been in your financial bucket. They often did not provide timely information we needed to truly manage the population. This was a recipe over a long period that caused many organizations to be unsuccessful. If I were running my own primary care group, I could absolutely be successful managing risk. It is when you get greedy and want to grow bigger or monetize what you have where things fail. There are pockets of success. I have known providers in Florida for 20 to 25 years who are still running highly profitable practices, smaller practices, where they take global risk and manage these patients exceptionally well. They know the patients really well. They are almost exclusively Medicare Advantage. And yes, the profitability per member may have gone down, mostly due to things outside their control. For example, provider specialties negotiating with health plans are pass-through costs to those providers that have gone up higher than the reimbursement trends. I could give you a number of examples, but the short answer is there are groups that can weather the storm and be successful long-term. I haven't followed Astrana that much, but you probably have your finger on the pulse with these guys. How much of their business is commercial versus Medicare? Medicaid versus Medicare under risk or under management, as opposed to the hospital side? That is probably telling. The hospitals are starting to recover, so if that is 20% of their business, I think they can survive. If the rest of the business is diversified enough and the contract structures are such that they are not disadvantaged like many contracts I was describing that P3 entered into, they should be fine. I know of one block of business that Astrana entered into with Anthem that was not a great block of business. It doesn't take a lot for a risk-bearing provider entity. One agreement can cause a lot of problems.
Tell me more about this Anthem block.
There was a block of business we had with Anthem that was heavy in the homeless population. Trying to manage that population is very difficult. Organizations like CityBlock have figured out how to manage that really difficult block of business. But your traditional Medicare Advantage risk-bearing provider entity has not done as good a job managing the homeless population, and they are often duals. Regardless of whether they have been duly qualified, Anthem was notorious, at least in one market I can think of, where they would send a captive agent and drop them in front of a Salvation Army and enroll patients because they did not have risk for it. Managing it does not take a lot of patience to accumulate large losses. We terminated that block of business at P3 and dispersed it to other organizations, some of which Astrana picked up. If you are picking up that kind of business, Lord help you. I haven't seen their contracts, but as long as they are not too overly dependent on Medicare, and their commercial and Medicaid contracts are written such that they don't have 100% downside risk, they should be able to weather the storm long term.
If we had a chance to speak with Brandon, what would be a checklist of things you would need to see or want to ask about to confirm good business versus bad business?
With regard to where they have downside risk, I would want to understand what they are doing to medically manage those patients. What is the path of increasing the top line other than only growing membership? When we were at Healthcare Partners, we 100% controlled the commercial network on our own paper. I don't know whether that is the case for Astrana in each of the markets they are in.
We had a fixed per member per month reimbursement that was risk adjusted, benefit adjusted, and age sex adjusted. It was not dependent on underwriting.
Wouldn't that all get captured in the risk scoring anyway?
It is more difficult on the commercial side.
Was the risk adjustment in commercial?
Yes, that would be one thing I would want to know, depending on what percentage of their total business was commercial.
That is all public. Their business is roughly 60% Medicare, 30% Medicaid, and 10% commercial in terms of revenue.
If they have 60% Medicare, that is where I would be focusing.
In terms of lives, it is actually 2/3 Medicaid.
My guess is that is heavily Medi-Cal.
90% of the business is in California. Let me throw in some other things that are just public. Full risk contracts cover 80% and fee-for-service 20%. And 40% of their Medicare lives are at risk through the Accountable Care Organization or Medicare Shared Savings Program.
Knowing that, I think they can be successful in this space. We will see what happens with the state of California. If they were to ever start cutting the Medi-Cal funding to the health plans, that would flow downstream and could cause problems. There have been organizations that have been highly successful in that space for a long time. Even Healthcare Partners was a lower margin but lower risk space. They can probably continue to be successful in the Medi-Cal space, but I am more concerned about the Medicare space.
Practically speaking, you are back to a checklist of whether you need to be able to somehow have controls over enrollment practices, networks, and risk scoring. When I do manage it, how much density do I need? I could imagine a whole checklist, including a certain amount of density and control over the specialists needed.
There are probably 5 or 6 levers. Starting on the revenue side, it is ensuring that you are protected when CMS makes changes to the model, so held harmless.
Wouldn't that be an annual negotiation? CMS comes out with its rates sometime after the final notice, but before enrollment season starts. That would be when you sit down and finalize your terms with the health plan, with full knowledge of what changes CMS is making.
No, because you are generally doing multi-year contracts. It is not very common to have a big negotiation every year. The contracts I was doing were 3 to 5 year deals, so it is tough in theory.
If you are negotiating a percent of premium and CMS screws around with something, the health plans still need to get their premium back. As long as the health plans are pricing to a margin, they should, in theory, be setting rates to get you to a margin.
In theory, but that is not always practice.
How does that not happen in practice?
It is determined actuarially.
If the plan has already pushed the risk off on you, and they know their healthcare costs are only going to be 85% of premium, and then healthcare costs go up 10%, their administrative costs don't go up. They actually make more money, and you get crushed.
Correct. If you're not sitting at the table when the bids are done, you have no line of sight or say into it. If you don't represent a significant part of a contract with a plan, generally, they are not going to be very forthcoming in sharing that information. I always try to include bid protection language. If I was a significant part of the membership for a particular contract, I was at the table weighing in on what benefit changes should be. A plan who doesn't have downside risk shouldn't do something that could be problematic.
It is wild that you design the benefits, set the medical costs, and design the premiums, but you have to wear it for 3 years.
That is how this industry grew up. Unless you had enough clout, enough leverage.
If you were big enough, in theory, they would worry that you would not contract with them in the future, and they wouldn't have a viable network. How big do you need to be to have clout and leverage? What is the share of lives? If you were looking at a provider network, what would be the metrics you would look at to just the amount of clout?
I think if you were at 40 to 50% of a plan's population base.
Of the plan's population, or of a plan's population in a county?
Per contract, Medicare is both county-driven and contract-driven. At Healthcare Partners, we had some contracts where we might have been 25 to 35% of their membership in a geography in LA, for example. And we also controlled much of the PCP network. We always got into these difficult negotiations where both parties really needed each other. Nobody wins in war, but we had enough leverage to say, if it really came down to it, we probably would win because we controlled the PCPs. We felt that there was enough stickiness between the patient and the PCP that the patient would stay with the PCP, not with the health plan. Star rating determines the quality bonus, which is 5% of revenue. The top-line revenue itself is protecting that through contract negotiations. Oftentimes, what I saw was that a provider group may have been performing at a 4.5 or 5-star level, but if the plan lost their star rating, that affected us.
The good news there is, at least you see that. If I recall, stars are set on a 3-year cycle. On your 3-year contract, it might be that the last year of the contract, you are stuck because you were affected by stars you didn't expect.
That comes down to negotiating so that, ideally, you have negotiated and been held harmless. If the plan's star rating drops, they still have to pay you that bonus.
Do the plans actually negotiate star bonuses?
Yes, every negotiation is different. If you are a small player in the space, plans probably are going to tell you to go pound sand. But if you have enough leverage and knowledge of how to negotiate the contracts, and they want you bad enough...
Does Astrana have enough leverage in its markets, combined with Prospect?
In California, they do. But outside of California, I would probably say no.
They have 4 million lives, 90% of which are in California. That doesn't feel like a lot, given that over half of them are not Medicare. Only about a third of them are Medicare because of Medicaid and commercial. They have roughly 500,000 lives in California, which doesn't feel like a lot.
No, I would agree, especially as you start breaking it down by line of business. On the Medicaid side, you may be working with different plans than you would on some of the other lines of business. To your point, if they only have 10,000 Medicare Advantage lives in a county, it becomes more difficult negotiating the guardrails. You need to be buttoned up and have good language protections against the plan doing things on the revenue risk adjustment piece. Data was another area where oftentimes we wouldn't get timely and accurate data. If you don't have that, you are starting the year off in a bad position and trying to recover throughout the year.
They say that in virtually all of their contracts, they do utilization management, pre-authorization, and claims management. I think they are in the position of sending data to the payer, not the other way around.
Yes, which is good when you are fully delegated because you do control that. You still are dependent on getting the enrollment information, and not having that timely can be problematic. For example, every January, as you know,
they didn't tell you who was enrolled yet, so you don't know you are responsible for Edna's heart attack?
Exactly, and that happens more often than you think. If you don't have some kind of protection in the contract, you are going to lose money in the first month that you might not be able to make up the rest of the year. That was a problem. Also on the back end, even if you are delegated for claims, when you submit the encounter, I have seen some health plans less new to the Medicare Advantage space, like Aetna and all the blue plans, that frankly just didn't understand the business and had difficulty submitting everything to CMS. One thing that we did really well at Healthcare Partners was we tracked down to every patient, every diagnosis, from the time that patient came in all the way until it was reconciled and accepted by CMS. That whole data reconciliation process, making sure that the data that the delegated risk-bearing groups submit to the plans, number one, 100% or 99.9% of that gets to the plan and doesn't get lost, and that the plan submits it to Medicare, and 99% of that gets through the edits, and that on the back end, it is all accepted. That risk adjustment reconciliation process was one very large area where a lot of revenue was lost. I would pressure test with anybody, Astrana or others, even ask the question, what percent of diagnoses of patients that you see and have reconciled were accepted by CMS? In a very tight ship, it is going to be 99%. I don't think a lot of risk-bearing provider groups have that expertise in-house. When you are working with some of these less sophisticated plans, they don't have the resources, knowledge, expertise, or wherewithal to even reconcile at that level. On the cost side, given that they are fully delegated, that helps because they control the network and prior authorization. Prior authorization is another thing that is changing because CMS is requiring that things be turned around more quickly. Oftentimes, you have to make a decision perhaps without full data, which can be challenging if you are denying. I think the pendulum is swinging to the provider side and the patient side as it pertains to prior authorization, which does not bode well for the plan in my mind. United and others are now starting to be slightly more open to pulling things off a prior authorization list, which can lead to cost increases. The fact that the majority of their business is delegated helps with the management. But we are also seeing providers, and I will be the first one to admit it, because now I have a lot of rheumatology business, going back looking for rate increases. If I am doing that, I have no reason to believe that a lot of other provider groups aren't doing the same. When you are bearing the risk, they are probably going to feel that pain. The question is, can the revenue offset the cost increases they are likely bearing? Pharmacy is another one. I know of many risk-bearing provider groups who are not taking pharmacy risk. I would be asking a number of questions about that, even if they are not taking pharmacy risk, because it is generally a losing proposition for a risk-bearing group. The pharmacy costs on the Part B side have gone up significantly. So if they don't have a good process in place to manage pharmacy costs, that is another area where risk-bearing provider groups can really get hit. Heritage does a really good job in this area and is another example of a group that continues to be successful to this day. They are now privately held, but from what I know, Regal Healthcare, Heritage Provider Network, and Dick Merkin have consistently done well and continue to do so.
Do you have any other thoughts?
Are you looking to advise or invest in Astrana Health, if you are at liberty to say?
We just invest in publicly traded stocks. If you were studying one of these things and thinking, are they built to last or not, what would you be looking for?
I think they have gotten hit lately. I am not sure if I were investing my own money, would I put it in Astrana Health or United? I would probably put it in United before Astrana Health.
Why do you say that?
United is a $400-plus stock. They have had a lot of headwinds. Once they get through legal issues and Medicare challenges, they will be fine. They control a lot of the providers downstream, and they are a smart company in terms of their contracting patterns. They have a lot of diversification. I think they are a safer bet than Astrana Health. You may disagree.
No, that is a safer bet. They have had a lot of issues, and they have a lot of market power.
I think they will get through this period. It was not sustainable for Optum to continue quarter after quarter, year after year, to not have a bad quarter. They are overpaying for a lot of deals, and at some point, that has to catch up with you. I think they got to the point where they couldn't keep wiping things under the rug and pushing it forward. They hit the reset button. The whole situation with Brian Thompson was terrible. But once they get through the new executive leadership changes and things stabilize, I think they are in a good position to weather the storm. They are huge and diversified and have many highly profitable businesses.
On Astrana Health, in Medicare, there is lots of data on members by plan and by county. Is there data like that for physician networks or anything remotely close that in theory, one could use to try to figure out members by provider network and by county?
You might be able to get access to some of the publicly reported data down to a provider level in terms of membership. Getting financial information or even membership, I am not sure.
Are there sources that give you membership by county?
I would probably go to some of the actuarial houses, such as Milliman. I think some of these have enough claims running through them where they can quickly figure out how much membership each of these larger provider groups have for that kind of data.
Tell me a bit about the competitive landscape. Who should I think of as the other provider networks that are competing with Astrana Health, both for patients on the one hand and payers on the other?
A big chunk of their lives are in California, where the competitors would be Optum and Regal Medical Group's Heritage Provider Network.
Anyone else?
Those are the two biggest ones in Southern California. I don't know how big they are in San Diego. I think they are bigger in the broader LA area, as I understand it.
They were born in the San Gabriel Valley, and I think they expanded broadly in LA. But when you add Prospect and the growth they have undertaken, I don't know exactly how big they are in all these places in California.
I don't know either. I have tried to avoid the LA market and even Inland Empire and San Gabriel Valley in that area.
Why?
It is a highly competitive area. So unless you have market share, it is tough. If they control the providers, and I think they do in their area, and have the lives, it is tough to break into a market like that.
How do you protect against patient dumping and enrollment, like adverse selection?
Through contracting.
That you may only enroll people outside the gym?
No, I had language around block transfers. So if somebody was moving a block of business in, we had some guardrails so that we were able to get some remuneration financially. Ultimately, if you have a captive agent who is selling to the homeless population and you are their only network in that geography, you will be susceptible to some very bad risk. I think the best you could do would be to have contractual language that prevented and/or compensated for it.
How would broker targeting a high-cost population manage that?
We didn't manage it well at P3. We tried to work with outside companies that really focused on a homeless population, but we were still unsuccessful. and ultimately ended up having to terminate the health plan. I don't know about Astrana. If you are working in inner city LA, then you better have a lot of healthcare resources in close proximity.
You can do your best to manage them once you have them. For a long time, Humana's secret sauce was they rolled out silver sneakers and parked brokers right outside the gym. It turns out, regardless of your risk score, if you are going to the gym and you value the gym benefit, you are a better risk. Whether you are among the type 2 diabetics with amputations, the ones going to the gym are the ones you want, right?
Correct.
I think CMS has estimated that the adverse selection against the fee-for-service system is a high single-digit percentage of the reason why Medicare Advantage plans get a lot of money. It would seem like that would be a very important thing that you would want to protect against if you were a plan taking all the risk.
If you go back far enough, you will remember that a lot of the enrollment meetings were on the second floor of a building where there wasn't an elevator.
Perfect. You have to be able to climb the stairs.
Yes, if you can climb the stairs, we will enroll you. But nowadays, you have some very acute populations. And I think the way to prevent it is to have the network infrastructure and care management programs to manage those highly complex patients.
You do all that, but that still costs more than the person not being sick to begin with.
Agreed. I think we will see a proliferation of PACE programs over time. Scan just started a company in that space to help address some of these highly complex patient populations.
These small, well-run, tight, local, dense provider networks can prosper for decades. But if you try to run it differently, like a Taco Bell, or you try to expand by bringing on new payer relationships, they come up with a new way to screw you that they hadn't thought of. If you try to expand too fast and the doctors don't know how to do it, you also get screwed. You could come up with some new contract terms that don't work out. The problem is there are umpteen ways to make a mistake here. It doesn't take a lot because it can be very severe. Combine that with technicality in the industry, and you can run into trouble. I think these guys have all found their way into trouble at some point.
I think you nailed it. In order for Astrana to achieve the growth that the street wants them to have, if they are going into new markets that they have never been in and don't have density of lives, I would be concerned.
Let's say you have 30% of lives and signed a 4-year deal with a health plan. If the health plan has 15%, you probably have the upper hand in terms of negotiating. But if they screw you on some of these contract things and it is not working, are you able to fire them during the contract, or do you have to wait until the end of the 4th year?
It is very difficult to get out of these global risk deals. If you are doing a 3-year deal and start seeing issues in year 1, the plans are doing their budgets a year in advance, particularly on the Medicare Advantage side. Trying to get mid-contract year modifications is very difficult. Doing one's due diligence at the outset of a contract is critically important. Nobody has a crystal ball, so you don't know what will happen in 3 years. Having some of those guardrails built into a contract allows for a renegotiation mid-contract if dynamics change.
Is there anything else I should be asking you about to understand it?
With Astrana and the Prospect acquisition, I would definitely want to ensure they won't have any surprises down the road from some of the Prospect purchases they made. How many hospitals do they still have?
There are only 2, and it is a small part of the business. It gets a lot of attention because it came with Prospect. One could worry it is a distraction, but it is not. Most of the activity in those hospitals serves the Prospect lives.
Then that is not as big of a risk. And it could probably benefit them if it is serving a disproportionate amount of Prospect risk-bearing lives and they manage it more like a Kaiser.
I think that is the theory.
The challenge that a lot of those companies historically have had is the hospital side is always heads and beds, and you get that dynamic against the population health side. It sounds like you obviously understand this space.
There are 3 levels of EMR connection. 1 is where they are fully integrated and in the EMR. Another is where they are using an EMR with tight data integration on the back end, so it is in a separate window. The 3rd is when you don't have integration to the EMR. You are working from claims data in a separate portal with a different IT stack. If I were to think about those 3 levels, how big a deal are those in terms of being able to manage lives?
The tighter the integration, the easier it is to influence the business. If you are integrated and submit data that gets fed via some pop-up, so the patient shows up and you know where all the gaps are, both quality and clinical, and they are getting closed and the patient is getting those addressed real time, you will have far better outcomes than in that third scenario. There, you would not see that the patient had a gap that could have been closed on that one visit of the year until you get a claim 60 days later. In my contracting strategy today, we don't employ a lot of providers. But as I am currently working on building an ACO network, I am mandating that the PCPs agree to have some kind of middleware overlaid in their EMR, regardless of their EMR, so that I can feed data and they can close those quality, risk adjustment, and clinical gaps. The more successful organizations will be skewed to that number one scenario you described, and the less successful organizations will be skewed to less integration. As time goes on and with AI, it can only continue to improve. There will be more ability to deliver better, more timely care the more integrated you are.
Why are these providers building brokerages to move lives between plans?
The more sophisticated groups don't own the brokerages. Instead, they partner with them. This is one area where P3 excelled because they managed an exclusive broker network. They managed it very closely, almost to the chagrin of the plans. These brokers were probably more loyal to the provider group than to the plan. The sophisticated groups will build those strong broker relationships, and some could even get to the point where they employ them. But I haven't seen that happen yet.
It seems to me that if you have a contract that is not working, a way you could try to ameliorate that would be to move those lives to a different contract. Maybe that contract would have better terms, so you could manage it better, for example. At a minimum, it would be like a hammer to use against the plan, to give them a reason to work with you more proactively.
You will obviously get into some ethical issues.
There is a strong obligation under law to do the very best for the patient, which might not be the case here.
Yes, but if hypothetically you had an exclusive broker network, as we did at P3, you can then begin incentivizing the broker to help you. For example, when a broker is enrolling a patient, they could ensure that patient is tucked in and scheduled. They could get accurate information that oftentimes plans don't have and feed that into the provider group. That way, before the patient is even effective, the provider group has access to some of their demographic information and can ensure that patient is being seen.
Get their home visit scheduled. Get them coded up. Get them on a preventative regimen even before they are on your risk.
And ideally prevent that admission on day one or two of the effective date before you have seen them. That is an area where we tried to get ahead of the pack in this regard. I haven't seen many organizations do what P3 did. We had an exclusive provider network that we were so dialed into. It was a win-win because the broker was able to commit to a prospective client. They could get them into a provider that others might not be able to get into and get them scheduled and seen.
I heard P3 had a big problem when many specialists were put into the network they didn't control. They were super high cost and couldn't be kicked out because it wasn't their network. Was that a big problem?
In some areas, but for the most part, no. In Arizona, which did represent a disproportionate amount of the total lives, they didn't have network management or delegation. It was highly dependent on the plan's provider networks. They were covering a large geography and didn't have the relationships necessarily with all of the specialists, so that was a problem. In Astrana's case, they are delegated for the network for 80% of their business, so they are probably not as susceptible to that. It is an issue I've seen happen in multiple markets. You could bring a national oncology group into your network, and your costs would double overnight on a per-month basis because of the way they practice.
On that note, is Everly really effective at managing high-cost categories well?
I have not had as many interactions with them. They claim they do, but I haven't seen it in practice enough to give you a good answer to that question.